effect on Israel. Due to the movement's popularity, Tel Aviv has lobbied European lawmakers to criminalize the group and its activities. France, Germany and Britain are key battlegrounds, but lesser known is the struggles of the BDS in Austria. Speaking to local members, a crackdown on BDS activism remains ongoing.
It started in 2018 when, for example, the local city government of Vienna, they implemented city resolutions, for example, against the BDS movement, where they say all local institutions and governmental institutions are not allowed anymore to support the movement, so which means all public places, they are restricted for us. And all these restrictions against the BDS movement in Austria, in Europe and worldwide, I think it's a reaction from the Zionist movement and from the Zionist lobby, because BDS is getting stronger and stronger.
The Vienna city government are currently suing a BDS Austria representative over a Facebook post showing an image plastered over an official city poster. Elsewhere, support for the BDS can get you labelled anti-Semitic due to Austria adopting the controversial IHRA definition on anti-Semitism.
European authorities are introducing new legislation which aims to stop the activities of the peaceful boycott campaign. But policing people's desires not to invest in the Israeli regime is proving a near impossible task. Speaking to representatives of the BDS here in Vienna, they say that the response is an inevitable backlash to the group's success in undermining and damaging Israel's reputation across the continent. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Turkey's Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu says he had a side talk with Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad on the sidelines of the Non-Aligned Movement Summit in October last year. The Turkish minister added he suggested a reconciliation to take a place between the Syrian government and the opposition, noting that without such a step, Syria will continue to face a crisis. Cavusoglu said that the EU and the international community would support a ceasefire in the war-torn country, and that no country would help in Syria's rebuild the process if a ceasefire is not achieved.
To prevent the division of Syria, there must be a strong administration in Syria. The will that can dominate every corner of its lands can only be achieved through unity and solidarity. We need to bring the opposition and government together for reconciliation. There will be no permanent peace otherwise.
Some believe such a revelation is a signal indicating Turkey is preparing for its cross-border military operation in northern Syria. In recent weeks, the Turkish army has been sending reinforcements to northern Syria, near the town of Tel Rifat. The town is under the control of Kurdish YPG forces, a U.S.-backed militia that Turkey considers the armed wing of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as PKK.
I think the timing of this announcement comes as Turkey's preparing for a cross-border military operation to secure the border area and push back Kurdish forces. A reconciliation between the government and the opposition will not only bring peace to Syria, but also Turkey, a country that has been directly affected by the Syrian war, from terrorist attacks to the refugee crisis.
Some analysts believe Turkey has long been serving its own agenda in Syria. For example, by supporting some opposition groups inside Syria who served Ankara's interest in securing its borders and pushing Kurdish forces back. It might be soon to say whether Ankara has changed its strategy in regards with Syria. What is clear for Turkey is that fighting or defeating the Kurdish militants cannot guarantee its security. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Gas bills in Italy will likely double in cost from October the 1st if gas prices continue to rise this way. The recent announcement by power regulator ARERA has gone utterly unnoticed, with the Italian media focusing on the electoral campaign about a month away from the September 25 national elections. A week ago, the outgoing Italian government unveiled a 17 billion euros aid package aimed at protecting families from surging energy costs and rising consumer prices. However, ARERA and some energy experts have warned that very little has been done so far to reduce energy consumption in the country.
Italy's highly critical energy situation has been downplayed by politicians and the media. On one side, there is confidence about the country achieving its target of reaching storage levels of 90%, while on the other side, the risk that Russia could altogether stop the flow of gas to Italy has been underplayed.
Gas is central to Italy's energy systems. The country even produces over 50% of its electricity from natural gas. Rome has cut its reliance on Russian gas imports to 25% from about 40% at the start of the year, a decision that has thrown the energy sector into uncertainty. Some analysts have predicted annual gas bills could reach an average of 1,800 euros next year, almost double the annual average of 950 euros recorded this year. Many Italians are simply bewildered about how they can find themselves in a position of not being able to heat or light their homes.
It's been this way forever. I used to be a unionist. I saw the crisis coming. This is how our country works. We don't have any sovereignty.
Nothing works in this country. We have forever been in the hands of a bunch of swindlers and criminals. Italy has no future.
The outgoing government is planning to offset its dependence on Russian gas by signing new deals with African and Eastern Mediterranean countries and building new regasification plants in a number of Italian sea towns, a move that has met with staunch opposition from local residents. Max Civili, Rome.
Rights groups have accused the Israeli regime of committing war crimes against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip during its three-day onslaught against the territory. On Friday, Israeli forces started launching wanton attacks on Gaza, killing and maiming hundreds of civilians, including women and children. The fighting stopped on Sunday through an Egypt-mediated ceasefire, but Palestinians now have to live with the devastating aftermath of Israeli attacks. According to Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians were systematic and deliberate and fall under Israel's strategy of using disproportionate and excessive force against civilians.
Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights reiterates its strongest condemnation of Israel's gross and systematic violations of international law, particularly in cases of extrajudicial killings and attacks against civilians and civilian objects. Such violations amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity for which those responsible must be held accountable.
Five wars have been unleashed between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza since 2008. The regime has been using U.S.-made warplanes and weapons to hit targets in the densely populated area.
The United States and Israel are both responsible for the bloodshed in Gaza. Israel was given the green light from the United States to carry out the brutal attacks on Gaza under the watchful eye of the international community. Israel and the United States are partners in crime against the Palestinian people.
Human rights organizations say, based on the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, it is more than clear that Israel has been committing war crimes during its attacks on Gaza.
The impunity Israel continues to enjoy and the absence of accountability encourage Israeli officials to continue perpetuating war crimes against Palestinians. As evidenced by its latest aggression on Gaza, Israel does not hesitate to engage in prohibited acts of killing, including direct targeting of civilians. The International Criminal Court must at least investigate these crimes.
For decades now, there has been no pressure on Israel to stop its violence against civilians. Despite repeated and desperate pleas from human rights groups, the international community has stayed silent about the regime's atrocities against Palestinians.
Despite Israel's grave violations of international law, Palestinians continue to suffer due to international apathy. Now, rights groups are demanding that Israeli war criminals be brought to justice. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Tragedy, injustice and destruction prompted a group of London rights organizations to call an emergency demonstration in support of Palestine and Palestinians. The Israeli bombardment of Gaza was the worst it's been since the May 2021 war, that killed 260 Palestinians and destroyed thousands of homes and businesses. This new assault cost the lives of at least 47 Palestinians. A third of the scores killed were children. For those attending the demonstration opposite Downing Street, the official residence of the British Prime Minister, they needed to be present to raise their voice against the injustice.
What we've witnessed over the last few days is very familiar, but no less horrific. Once again, Israel has been bombing the Palestinian people in Gaza, claiming a right to self-defense. There's a reality here that any form of violence that is used to enforce occupation, used to enforce apartheid, used to enforce settler colonialism is by definition illegitimate. It is the Palestinian people who have a right to defence and to protect themselves.
One of the main themes linking the speakers at this event is the fact that the Israeli aggression is only made possible by the tacit support of states like the British, and that Palestinian blood remains on British hands.
The UK has obligations under international humanitarian law and the Geneva Convention to look after the people who are occupied rather than stand with the oppressor, with the world's 21st century apartheid state. They must stop. They must support the Palestinians in real terms, not through words, two-state solution, which means absolutely nothing, but in sanctioning Israel, because that's the next thing that needs to happen.
Your policy on the Palestinians has to change. Justice has to prevail. And the way the hypocrisy, the way they do deal with the Palestinian issue and other issues like the Ukrainian issues, for example, is at least we can say a hypocritical way of dealing with it. So therefore, we are here today to raise our voice and tell them that this is not acceptable.
Though a ceasefire is supposed to be in force, commentators point out that this simply means Israel has moved its campaign of aggression to other parts of occupied Palestine, including Nablus, where there have already been casualties, raising the specter of an escalation resulting in further Palestinian blood being shed. Amina Taylor, London.
Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference on the dire situation of Yemeni children amid the years-long Saudi war on the country. The ministry has criticized the United Nations for its inaction on Saudi atrocities.
When the United Nations removed Saudi Arabia from the list of violators of children's rights, it encouraged the kingdom to continue killing Yemeni children and targeting service facilities for children such as schools, hospitals and health centers. It also prevented the entry of humanitarian and medical aid for children. We know that there are UN reports that talk about the spread of malnutrition amongst children, along with many chronic diseases that need care. But unfortunately, there is no real action to save the children of Yemen.
Officials say the UN has collaborated with the Saudi-led coalition in killing Yemeni children by providing political cover-up for Riyadh's violations. Moreover, the world body removed the kingdom from the list of groups accused of violating children's rights.
The United Nations is a clear and prominent partner in the aggressive war on Yemen, and we have in the 8 years of war clear evidence that the United Nations participated in all the crimes committed against the Yemenis and did not condemn Saudi Arabia for its crimes, but rather the victims bear everything the executioner does. The United Nations has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children through its silence and coverage of Saudi crimes. It has also removed Saudi Arabia 5 times from the list of violators of children's rights.
According to human rights groups, more than 9,000 children have been killed or maimed by Saudi airstrikes since the beginning of the war in 2015. Health officials say more than 1 million children are suffering from malnutrition, one of the highest numbers in the world.
Human rights activists say the United Nations is hostage to Saudi Arabia's funding for its programs. They say the world body has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children because of its silence on Saudi crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
At least one lawyer for former President Donald J. Trump signed a written statement in June asserting that all material marked as classified and held in boxes in a storage area at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence and club had been returned to the government, four people with knowledge of the document have said. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Maggie Haberman, Glenn Thrush, Katie Banner, and Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Trump Lawyer Told Justice Department That Classified Material Had Been Returned. Please stay with us for more. At least one lawyer for former President Donald J. Trump signed a written statement in June asserting that all material marked as classified and held in boxes in a storage area at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence and club had been returned to the government, four people with knowledge of the document have said. The written declaration was made after a visit on 3rd of June to Mar-a-Lago by J. I. Bratt, the top counterintelligence official in the Justice Department's National Security Division. The existence of the signed declaration, which has not previously been reported, is a possible indication that Donald Trump or his team were not fully forthcoming with federal investigators about the material. And it could help explain why a potential violation of a criminal statute related to obstruction was cited by the department as one basis for seeking the search warrant used to carry out the day-long search of the former president's home on Monday, an extraordinary step that generated political shockwaves. It also helps to further explain the sequence of events that prompted the Justice Department's decision to conduct the search after months in which it had tried to resolve the matter through discussions with Donald Trump and his legal team. An inventory of the material taken from Donald Trump's home that was released on Friday showed that FBI agents seized 11 sets of documents during the search with some type of confidential or secret markings on them, including some marked as classified TSSCI, that is shorthand for Top Secret Sensitive Compartmented Information. Information categorized in that fashion is meant to be viewed only in a secure government facility. The search encompassed not just the storage area where boxes of material known to the Justice Department were being held, but also Donald Trump's office and residence. The search warrant and inventory unsealed on Friday did not specify where in the Mar-a-Lago complex the documents marked as classified were found. Donald Trump said on Friday, 12th of August, that he had declassified all the material in his possession while he was still in office. He did not provide any documentation that he had done so. In an appearance on Fox News Channel on Friday night, the right-wing writer John Solomon, whom Donald Trump has designated as one of his representatives to interact with the National Archives, read a statement from the former president's office claiming that Donald Trump had a standing order during his presidency that documents removed from the Oval Office and taken to his residence were deemed to be declassified the moment he removed them. A spokesman for the former president, Taylor Budowich, which on Saturday, 13th of August, just like every Democrat fabricated witch hunt previously, the water of this unprecedented and unnecessary raid is being carried by a media willing to run with suggestive leaks, anonymous sources, and no hard facts. The search warrant said FBI agents were carrying out the search to look for evidence related to possible violations of obstruction statute, as well as the Espionage Act, and a statute that bars the unlawful taking or destruction of government records or government documents. No one has been charged in the case, and the search warrant on its own does not mean anyone will be charged. Last year, officials with the National Archives discovered that Donald Trump had taken a slew of documents and other government material with him when he left the White House at the end of his tumultuous term in January of 2021. That material was supposed to have been sent to the archives under the terms of the Presidential Records Act. Mr. Trump returned 15 boxes of material in January of this year. When archivists examined the material, they found many pages of documents with classified markings and referred the matter to the Justice Department, which began an investigation and convened a grand jury. In the spring, the Justice Department issued a subpoena to Donald Trump seeking additional documents that it believed may have been in his possession. The former president was repeatedly urged by advisers to return what remained, despite what they described as his desire to continue to hold onto some of the documents. In an effort to resolve the dispute, Mr. Bratt and other officials visited Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida in early June, briefly meeting Donald Trump while they were there. Two of Donald Trump's lawyers, M. Evan Corcoran and Christina Bobb, spoke with Mr. Bratt and a small number of investigators he traveled with, people briefed on the meeting said. Evan Corcoran and Christina Bobb showed Mr. Bratt and his team boxes holding material that Donald Trump had taken from the White House that were being kept in a storage area, the people said. According to two people briefed on the visit, Mr. Bratt and his team left with additional material marked classified and around that time also obtained a written declaration from a Trump lawyer attesting that all the material marked classified in the boxes had been turned over. A short time after the meeting, according to people briefed on it, Mr. Bratt sent Evan Corcoran an email telling him to get a more secure padlock for the room. Donald Trump's team complied. The Justice Department also subpoenaed surveillance footage from Mar-a-Lago recorded over a 60-day period, including views from outside the storage room. According to a person briefed on the matter, the video footage showed that after one instance in which Justice Department officials were in contact with Donald Trump's team, boxes were removed in and out of the room. That activity prompted concern among investigators about the handling of the material. It is not clear when precisely the video footage was from during the lengthy back and forth between Justice Department officials and Mr. Trump's advisers, or whether the subpoena to Donald Trump seeking additional documents had already been issued. Mr. Budowich said it was no surprise that boxes may have been moved in and out of a storage room. That's not news, he said. If there was actual concern, the Department of Justice could have asked, just like they had previously, and they would have, again, received full cooperation. In recent months, investigators were in contact with roughly half a dozen of Donald Trump's current aides, who had knowledge of how the documents that had been kept at Mar-a-Lago were handled, two people briefed on the approaches said. At least one witness provided the investigators with information that led them to want to further press Donald Trump for material, according to a person familiar with the inquiry. Concern about Donald Trump's cavalier handling of classified information dates back to the early days of his administration. When Donald Trump left office, President Biden quickly took the extraordinary step of barring him from receiving the intelligence briefings traditionally provided to former presidents, saying that Mr. Trump could not be trusted because of his erratic behavior. The security of classified information at Mar-a-Lago was also a concern for government officials even while Mr. Trump was in office. During his presidency, the government built what is known as a SCIF, a sensitive compartmented information facility, for Donald Trump's use while he was at the club, Mar-a-Lago. Expressing alarm about the documents that were retrieved from Mar-a-Lago, the leaders of two House committees on Saturday called on Avril D. Haines, the Director of National Intelligence, to conduct an immediate review and damage assessment and provide a classified briefing to Congress about the potential harm done to national security. Former President Trump's conduct has potentially put our national security at grave risk, the committee leaders, Representatives Carolyn Maloney, Democrat of New York, and the chairwoman of the Oversight Committee, and Adam Schiff, Democrat of California and the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, wrote to Ms. Haines. On Thursday, Attorney General Merrick Garland made a public statement saying he had personally authorized the decision to seek the search warrant for Donald Trump's property, and he indicated that the Justice Department would have made such a move only after trying less invasive measures. Shortly before, Merrick Garland made the announcement a person close to Donald Trump reached out to a Justice Department official to pass along a message from the former president to the Attorney General. Donald Trump wanted Merrick Garland to know that he had been checking in with people around the country and found them to be enraged by the search. The message that Donald Trump wanted conveyed, according to a person familiar with the exchange, was, "The country is on fire. What can I do to reduce the heat?" The following day, as a judge unsealed the warrant and the inventory of items that the FBI took, Donald Trump alternately claimed he did nothing wrong and also made the baseless statement that officials may have planted evidence at his property, Mar-a-Lago, during the search.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The study has revealed that the U.S. has waged 400 wars since its founding, a quarter of them in West Asia and in Africa. What does that say about the founding fathers of the U.S. to present-day leaders? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. has what appears to be war as a doctrine, why it has focused on Africa and West Asia to wage these wars, and why it has not won any wars recently, despite waging so many of them. Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, who joins us from Madison. We also have journalist and author Daniel Lazar joining us from New York. Welcome to you both. Daniel Lazar, I'll start with you. The name of the study, Introducing the Military Intervention Project, a new data set on U.S. military interventions. Which sounds with a lot of bells and whistles there. Okay. The U.S. undertook almost 400 military interventions from its founding in 1776 to 2019. It sounds like a lot. The research we did supports the numbers. Then the question comes about, why is the U.S. relying on military interventions in such a way, or executing it, I should say, in such a way?
Well, that's about one intervention every 8 months, when you consider the U.S. has been around for about 250 years or so. The U.S. is a state. It's very aggressive. It's violent, like all states are violent. But this violence has certainly exploded since World War II, when the U.S. led the step forth and emerged as the leader of the global crusade against communism. And then it took another leap upwards in 1991, when the Soviet bloc collapsed. The U.S. was the last superpower left standing. So the U.S. Did its best to assert its global hegemony across the world, and that meant a dramatic increase in military conflicts. And then there was yet another increase after 9/11, when the U.S. Stepped up its military warfare, and especially with regard to the Middle East, started pouring arms into the region, fostering war, invading it itself, of course, and essentially bringing about chaos from one end of the region to the other.
Let's go to what you pointed out there, Daniel Lazar, and I'll ask you, Kevin Barrett, about back in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed. The U.S. was left to be the dominant military power. Why then was there an increase in the military interventions? Why wasn't there a decrease? What led the U.S. towards down that path?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I remember back then that there was a widespread feeling that Americans and the world would be getting a peace dividend. We look forward to a big reduction in government expenditures, big reduction in taxes, and an enhanced civilian economy. And somehow that didn't happen. And I think that the people who profit from these wars, who became part of the national security complex, which is really an imperial kind of bureaucratic and corporate and criminal overlapping set of worlds, that these people profit mightily from war. And they wanted to make sure that those wars continued. So they began pretty half-heartedly in the 1990s with interventions in Eastern Europe and things like that, continuing to rain death on Iraq by killing Iraqi children through sanctions, things like that. But I think they recognized that that wasn't sustainable because of the general tenor of public opinion in the U.S., which has always followed George Washington's dictate that the U.S. should never be involved in foreign quarrels. And indeed, the founding fathers believe there should only be a military that gets called up in the event of the U.S. being attacked and invaded externally, as happened in the War of 1812. Of course, that set of beliefs of the public has never really matched reality very well. But I think they had to change that. And so that's why we got the September 11th, 2001 New Pearl Harbor. That was a false flag event that was modeled after the original Pearl Harbor, which had been the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor that was actually orchestrated by an 8-point plan put together by the Roosevelt Brain Trust under supervision of British intelligence. And that the Pearl Harbor scam was used to turn around 80% plus U.S. public opinion against entry into World War II. And suddenly overnight, the entire American public, with a very, very few exceptions, welcomed U.S. Involvement in World War II. And then that mentality continued after the war and allowed for this vastly increased level of militarism. So they did the same thing in 2001. They created a new Pearl Harbor, which indeed the very defense intellectuals who orchestrated this had actually openly yearned for in a September 2000 document called Rebuilding America's Defenses. They basically called for a new Pearl Harbor. And so then they got it when their operatives blew up the World Trade Center with explosives and attacked the Pentagon, blamed it on Muslims, which was completely false. Those 19 guys they blamed were not even on the planes. At least there's no evidence that they were. So that event, that great deception, was used to condition the American public, just as Pearl Harbor conditioned them to believe that they had to go out and try to rule the world in order to not be vulnerable to the surprise attack. The same mentality reigned after September 11th, and Americans became completely irrational, gave up their desire for a peace dividend, gave up whatever remnants of belief in George Washington's foreign policy they had. And so the imperial warmongers were free to double their military budget, to increase their biological warfare budget by 10,000% in the wake of the false flag anthrax attack by the U.S. biodefense sector on the U.S. Congress, and do everything that they've done since then, which is essentially turn the U.S. into the most criminal, militaristic dictatorship that's ever existed.
Well, I'd like to find out how we got to that point. And Daniel Lazar, it's hard to really try to follow the way that this transpired. But I'm going to go along the lines of the number of U.S. military bases, which is roughly around 800. Where did this number and how did this number really come about? I mean, you know, you go through year by year, and there's a think tank of some kind, or it's deep inside the Pentagon. Let's have a U.S. base here. Let's have one over there. How does it get to be to the point where there's so many of them and for the U.S. to have the biggest military spending, or not defense, military spending of around roughly $800 billion. How did the U.S. get to that point?
Well, let me just begin by saying that Kevin Barrett is a friend of mine. I like him very much, but I disagree with him profoundly about Pearl Harbor or 9/11. Pearl Harbor was an attack by the Japanese, and 9/11 was truly an attack by Al-Qaeda's origins are tied up with the U.S. Sponsored war in Afghanistan, but that attack was quite real. It was not carried out by American operatives of any sort. And as for why there are
evidence against those innocent 19 men,
and as why there are 800 bases around the world. Well, after 1991, the U.S. became the global hegemon, and it felt it was its responsibility to patrol the entire globe. And that meant putting into operation a very complicated structure of military domination. And that involved 800 bases or so, give or take 50, around the globe. And the U.S. also set out to outspend the rest of the world. I mean, I think U.S. spending is now it's greater than that of the next 10 nations combined. So the U.S. turned itself into a global military colossus whose purpose is to control the globe, control the earth in a way that is conducive to America's profits, its economic growth, its attempt to further its superpower status,
etc. Let me jump in when you say that, because when you say the U.S. Has all these military bases, which I pose to you as a question, you also said that the U.S. is out to control the world. What right does it give the U.S. through its military to then feel through that it can control the world? I mean, is that the type of thinking? I'm just trying to make sure I'm clear on this.
It gives it no right at all, of course. You're absolutely correct. It's an excellent question. The U.S. has no moral right. It has no legal right under international law. You're correct, but it's a case of might makes right. the U.S. Has this huge military structure, which the rest of the world can't say no to, and therefore it uses it to enforce its will around the globe. Now, the problem today is that a growing number of countries are saying no, such as Russia, Iran, and China. So therefore, that has the U.S. deeply upset and is leading to to ever more aggressive actions by the imperial center.
So if might is right, Kevin Barrett, doesn't that go hand in hand with U.S. foreign policy to make these countries where U.S. has military bases, as an example, that, okay, this is our line, and you're either with us or you're with them in a sense, but I'm sorry, that's a quote from somebody else. So is that how it goes, parallel with the U.S. Military bases and defense spending, that the countries need to follow the U.S. foreign policy?
Well, of course, the U.S. has used these military bases and other forms of power to push around the governments of other countries in all sorts of different ways. And one of the ways that we haven't heard much about in the Western media is the history of U.S. nuclear threats against other nations. I have a book somewhere on my bookshelves documenting, I forget precisely how many dozens of such direct threats to use nuclear weapons against other nations. And so this is a kind of bullying and intimidation set tactic. It's a little bit like the mafia with its threats. It's obviously corrupt, and it is about various forms of profiteering. And those forms can be obvious, as is the case of the way that the U.S. military is used to keep the billionaire oligarch elite of the West in a position to continue robbing the world blind and robbing their own societies blind as well. We don't tolerate governments that are strong enough to protect their own citizens, much less anybody else, against the depredations of our neoliberal oligarchs. So that part is obvious. There are also all sorts of other ways that people within and around the so-called military-industrial complex profit from this empire. And one of the biggest and least known by consumers of mainstream media is drug smuggling. That is, that it's not that widely known, unfortunately, that since the late 1940s, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency has been by far the world's biggest illegal drug smuggler. And I highly recommend the book on Operation Gladio by, I forget, the former Fox News correspondent of all people who wrote it, that documents how the CIA saw that Chiang Kai-shek had managed to finance his war operations using illegal narcotics money, and that whoever did this was going to have a big edge up in ruling the world. And so the CIA got into that game, and they ended up using the Vatican Bank as their biggest single money laundry. I think a lot of Catholics would be shocked to know this. So there's a lot of criminal profiteering that goes on. It's no obviously no coincidence that Vietnam happened right there in the Golden Triangle, where the U.S. was shipping back vast amounts of heroin in the bodies of dead soldiers, in the coffins of dead soldiers. The film Air America documents this. And then it's no coincidence that we went into Afghanistan at a time when the Taliban had shut down the heroin industry. And the first thing that the U.S. forces did was free the drug lords and set them to work. And within 2 years, record profits, record crops were being generated. So there are all sorts of these corrupt ways of profiteering that justify the imperial depredations of the empire. And that's I think these are the kinds of real reasons why the U.S. is doing this, not any kind of belief in the superiority of the American system or the need for a rules-based international order and all this nonsense. They're just a bunch of corrupt criminal types who are making money from it, and they want to continue making money.
Okay, since you talked about profits and money, arms sales for the U.S., it has been a top supplier based on SIPRI to West Asia or Middle East, where the U.S. arms export, Daniel Lazar, increased from 32% to 37% over the last 5 years. This being a report from the year 2019, I should mention, with imports by Middle East and North Africa growing by 25%. Well, guess what? The study that we talked about, the topic of this program, reveals that the U.S. has waged these wars, a quarter of them in West Asia and in Africa. Is this a coincidence? And why then is West Asia and Africa the focus?
Well, first, it's not a coincidence. The U.S. pours money pours arms into these regions in order to destabilize them and thereby control them all the more more effectively. But the reason is resources. In the case of the Middle East, it's oil. I mean, oil is what capitalism has run on for the last century. It is absolutely crucial to industrial capitalism as it is now constructed. And so therefore, you know, the Middle East has become the great prize. The U.S. has poured, you know, incredible resources, literally trillions of dollars, into militarizing the Middle East. And and what are the consequences? The consequences of the region has been torn by one major war after the other. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, have been killed. Entire countries have been laid waste, such as Syria and Yemen. Others like Iraq have been destroyed. Iran has been under an economic siege since the 1980s. And meanwhile, the U.S. is arming to the teeth Saudi Arabia, perhaps the most repressive single government on the face of the earth. And the U.S. does this all in the name of democracy. I mean, it's a complete joke. But the effect of all this is to cause living conditions to plummet in these regions.
Well, then let me ask you this, Kevin Barrett. If the U.S. was not to be involved in these militaristic approaches that it has had, i.e. wars, what kind of world would we be living in now? Because right now, Afghanistan is a mess. Iran is being threatened right and left with either through Israel, which is a U.S. ally, not to mention other countries in West Asia, which are either unstable or teetering on it, such as Syria. We're looking at the U.S., Ukraine, conflict. I'm sorry, it's the Russia-Ukraine conflict, but the U.S. obviously is in there somewhere. And then you have China, and we're seeing what's happening there. But what if the U.S. wasn't involved at all? What kind of world would we be living in now?
Well, there are a lot of indications that it would be much more peaceful and prosperous, certainly in West Asia. If we look at what the U.S. has done to whom and why, what we see over and over is the same pattern, that when a country starts becoming reasonably prosperous because its leadership is putting the interests of its own people first, that's when the U.S. attacks. That's what we did to Saddam Hussein in Iraq. For all of his many faults and crimes, Saddam Hussein had basically eliminated corruption from that country, except within his own family, of course, and had built the living standards, the infrastructure, and the educational levels up to near first world levels. And that's why Iraq had to be destroyed. And likewise with Gaddafi in Libya, who had brought Libya into the 21st century as by far the most prosperous country in Africa. And that's why Libya had to be destroyed as well. Iran has been a surprising success economically, despite the incredible sanctions and the opposition of so much of the world ever since the 1979 revolution. Still, Iran has done reasonably well, and that's why Iran is still facing so much hostility. And then if we look at just what happened in Pakistan, Imran Khan had actually presided over an incredibly successful couple of years where the economic growth shot up to 6-7%. Because Imran Khan was following policies that would benefit the Pakistani people by trading with partners like China that are interested in trade rather than just depredation. And so the U.S. overthrew Imran Khan's government, as it always overthrows and targets governments that put the best interests of their own people first. So if we didn't have this U.S. empire destroying countries and overthrowing governments that are, in fact, working on behalf of their people, we would probably have a much more peaceful and prosperous planet. All of that money that's being wasted in death and destruction would be saved, and the world would be much better off.
Well, this is what the U.S. has said, Daniel Azar, and I'm going to read off a particular organization that I'm going to ask you who you think has released this, where it says, as a title, the U.S. strategy to prevent conflict and to promote stability, priority countries and region. The U.S. government is moving forward in the spirit of partnership with countries and a regional grouping of countries to implement the 10-year U.S. strategy to prevent conflict and to promote stability. Can you guess what organization has actually stated that?
I would suggest the National Security Council.
USAID.
USAID.
Exactly.
Okay, but
from the American
classic.
People. So they're using this organization, and this is their line, but we know that USAID has been involved in regime change operations in Cuba, in Russia, and perhaps elsewhere. Cuba and Russia distinctly stand out.
Yes. But this is the way America works. I mean, America sees itself as the font of justice and rightness. Everything America does is by definition right. Even when America makes mistakes, it's because it's too good. It's trying too hard to make the world a better place. So occasionally it oversteps. But in general, the fundamental assumption across the entire political spectrum, across the entire corporate press, is that America is good, it is just, it is correct, it is a country that is trying its best to make the world a better place. And so therefore, yes, when it wages war, it's really trying to wage peace. And it's only because other countries oppose its peacemaking efforts that war results. I mean, it's completely narcissistic reasoning. But that is how America works. That is the basic mental function of U.S. society in general.
All right. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. I'm going to thank our guests. Thank you for your input there, Daniel Lazar, journalist and author from New York. Kevin Barrett, thank you so much, editor at Veterans Today, who spoke to us from Madison. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the